This is a Connectability Radio production.
Sensory Indications for a Child with Special Needs with Jennifer Rodanicic, Occupational Therapist with CODA. Part 2, Strategies.
Good morning. Welcome to our first workshop of the day, Sensory Indications for Children with Special Needs. I want to, it's a great pleasure to introduce Jennifer Rodanicic. Jennifer is an OT working for CODA, and she has lots of other
kinds of
And she's been with CODA for 8 years, and has been working on contracted community living in Toronto, so a lot of us have had the opportunity of working with Jennifer as well. And she leads parent workshops for the Jumpstart program at Geneva Center. And Jennifer is just wonderful, and I know you're going to get a lot of information this morning. So welcome, Jennifer.
So I alluded to the fact that we all need to stay in a nice, calm, alert state of attention to be our best. Okay? So really, the best thing that we need to do for these children is to make sure that they are at an optimal arousal level. If they are if their instinct is running too high, if they're anxious, if they're moving around, if they're not able to focus, we need to bring their engine down. If their engine, and essentially, I'm using the word engine because it, to me, makes a little bit more sense and more visual than the arousal level. If your engine is running low, then you bring it up. Okay, so each child is going to need a different kind of input. Most of the problems that I come across are when the children's engine is running too high, okay? Because, of course, those are the children that cause us the most trouble because they're the noisiest, the ones that move around the most aggressive. But, of course, we would hope that we're not going to ignore the quiet, non-functioning child at the back in the corner. We also need to appreciate whether they're performing at their optimal level, okay? But of course, it's human nature that the squeaky wheel gets oiled. So we're going to probably talk more about calming strategies today than alerting. However, please, if you have a child you're thinking about for alerting tasks, let me know, and we will talk about that too. So we want to look at activities that can be calming. The main activity that is calming is pressure and resistance. So if you recall those two words, I did speak of them earlier this morning, and they were connected with proprioceptive input. Proprioceptive input will be the basis of your strategies for calming. If you do not have proprioceptive activities in your calming ideas, you're not going to get too far. Okay. It is the most effective for the body to calm. Resistive activities, same as pressure. Linear rocking, so rocking in one line, is calming slowly. So what we do to a baby, an infant. Okay. Alerting would be rotation, so spinning a child around that needs to be woken up a little bit. Spin them around. Loud noises. Bright colors. I don't have it today, but I went shopping after I went to a sensory workshop a few years ago, and she talked about painting a child's room bright orange if they have low arousal, for children that are hard to wake up in the morning, and you give them a black bowl on a white tablecloth. And so I went out and I came home with an orange jacket. And I've never bought an orange jacket before. But I think I had sensory stuff on my brain. And I love my orange jacket because it does keep me awake. And so children who tend to have this low engine, who need to be stimulated and worked up, should have nice, bright, contrasting colors, wear them on them so they can wake themselves up. Okay? Food can be very powerful. Sucking is calming and organizing. Crunchy is alerting. Okay? Sour is alerting. It wakes you up. Okay? So we're going to do a little sensory diet today together, and we want to keep in mind how we can use our meals actually as part of our sensory diet, and how we present food can be very effective for children. I would like us to actually, I know we had a break, but I would like us to stand up, and I'll give a nice example of another calming activity. These are joint compressions that you can do on yourself. Now, you might not be able to see me because I'm not very tall. So what you do is take your hands and you push them together as hard as you can and count to 10. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Then you pull your hands apart as hard as you can. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Feeling it really in your shoulders. Then you put your hands on your head, go on your tiptoes, and fold back on your knees like you want to break the floor. Okay, you ready? 10 times. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Good. So that might make you wake up, might make you alert. Some of us might feel the effects of that. Some of us might feel more energized, more alert, more awake. Some of us, that may not have affected us. Okay, everyone is going to be responding differently. Okay, I certainly feel more together, more ready after I do that sort of activity. So you can do things that are on their own, like a joint compression, but you also want to be able to integrate sensory activities into your day, because we have other things to do, right? So it's going to make it a lot easier if you can find ways to incorporate activities into your day. And that brings us to a sensory diet, and I hope many of you have heard this term before. Some of you have heard this term before. It is a terminology we use for, it's essentially a routine of sensory activities. Its goal is to help children maintain calm, that calm alert state, and to help them deal with sensory sensitivities or under responsiveness to input. So all those problems we talked about, this is one strategy that can be employed to help children feel less sensitive or be able to respond more to their environment, and also to stay at that calm alert state. We want to provide input throughout the day. We do not want to only react to a child's behavior. We want to be proactive. And so a sensory diet would be a series of activities that you're going to do regardless of how you think the day is going to go. You're just going to do them because it's 10 o'clock and now it's time for the child to push all the chairs in. Okay? If you have a day where the child's having more difficulty, maybe more sensitive to noise, more sensitive to touch, having more difficulty staying calm and alert, you're going to probably do more things. All right? But you want to have a good base, because that sensory diet can help reduce or eliminate some of those outbursts or aggression that you have on a daily basis. And obviously, it is best and ideal for it to be done at home and at the center. However, because many children are at daycare for a long period of time, you can still make a difference for this child if the center is the only place that they receive this input. So please don't not do it because the parents can't do it at home. We need the parents' permission. We need the parents to say it's okay. But if the parent is unable to follow through and organize their day, we can still make a difference. Okay? We really, truly can. The longer that a child can stay at the calm alert state, the more learning they do. So it translates for you as better circle time, more tasks being completed, more social engagement being done. So there's a huge payoff for having children at a calm alert state. And we do put this as a sensory diet because it's the idea that the body is hungry. The body is hungry for something. Not for food, but for input. Okay? Maybe it's oral stimulation. the body's hungry for it. So when you're hungry, you feed your body. Okay, so again, we're not saying no, we're just saying not, don't do this, but do this. Alright? We're saying, yes, you're hungry, but in, for the food analogy, we'll say, yes, you're hungry, but don't eat the chocolate, have an apple. You're confirming the child that needs something, but you're going to give an appropriate strategy. Okay? So I thought that we could do a little bit of a sensory diet because it takes the mystery out of what it means to make a sensory diet. And when your OT comes to your center and gives you activities to do, you can develop a sensory diet. I don't want you to make a sensory diet on your own without the OT assessment, but you are going to be the ones that are going to know when the activities are best to be done. When I write my reports, I usually give a list of activities that could be incorporated in a diet. But I cannot tell you what time of day that's going to be best. Okay? So you can certainly use your knowledge of the child and your routine to know when these activities fit best. Okay? And a sensory diet is not, it's not a recipe. It's like a menu. Okay, so if you start doing a sensory diet and we've suggested doing handstands and you find the child doesn't like them, it scares them, then don't do it. Just pick something else. Find what the child likes, what works best for them, because I won't know in one visit whether everything's going to work, and you might not know either. And it might take 3 weeks for you to figure out which activities are going to work best. Okay? So, for the sake of argument, do you mind if we pick a child that has who's very active? Is that okay? Because that's usually the ones that we don't understand. So, if we are thinking that the basis of this is a child, let's say, that is just sitting still, they don't sit in circle time, they're really have a hard time walking around, staying in this line. They're always running around. Let's say they are leaning up against other children in circles. They always are pulling and pushing and just seem very physical during the day. And let's say that they're mouthing toys. Okay. So in the morning we might have snacks, right? So if it's allowed in your daycare, you might be able to provide them with a straw. Okay. You might be able to have crunchy foods sometimes, not all day. Okay. Maybe when they are in circle time, can we think of a task that is resistant that a child could do just before they sit down for circle? Get the book. That's movement. So they're running around, so you give them movement, but in a purposeful way. So get the book. They could maybe, if you have a blackboard, they could clean the blackboard off. So that, you're doing a lot of upper body movement, very resistant. If you have circles or squares for kids to sit on, maybe they could. You can have them in a bin, and the child could push the bin over to the circle. You could purposely place the bin at the other end of the room, and Johnny goes and gets them and pulls that whole bin of rug squared over to the circle. Okay? Very, lots of labor. Okay? Okay, it's very good. Very good. So pulling that, pushing chairs in. These three things can be done during, like, in your routine. Doesn't take a lot of extra time. The blackboard, maybe they can do during tidy up time. If they're not really the greatest at tidying up, they might be able to do that. So you're really not, I'm not asking for a lot of time yet. There's not a lot of things I'd ask you to do separately. Okay? Perhaps maybe in circle, we could use a cushion. They might sit better at circle with their beanbag chair. Or they might like to sit on an air-filled cushion like this. When they sit on this cushion, they get movement. Okay, they can't sit still. They actually move. So the air makes the move. Okay? So the brain gets the message, I'm moving. So the child doesn't have to move on their own. they're getting it from the cushion. And it's much more effective and efficient for the body to receive this movement. So the child will still move, but they won't have to move as much, and they'll be staying more in one spot because the cushion is there. Okay? Then try. Sometimes it works. Sometimes I get calls saying, oh my goodness, he sits in a circle better than everyone else now. Or, no, it doesn't work. Okay? So again, you have to try and see. But maybe this child needs movement to pay attention, which is a problem at school. Maybe some of you actually didn't do well sitting at school because you don't do well when you're sitting still. You do better when you're moving around. So this cushion can be very helpful in that sense. Mean day chair is good. So they're outside. Maybe they can pull the bin of toys from the shed to the middle of the play area, if you have any. So they can pull the bins. They can hold the door, maybe. Now, I know you need to give everyone a turn, but that child can be picked maybe more frequently than the others. And you really want to see if they can use their hands to hold the door, not their shoulders, but hold it like this. It's going to be harder for them. It's going to be more work. They're going to get more resistance. So then it's going to calm them more. Okay? And outside, you probably don't need to worry about them moving around, because this is probably where they shine. They roam around, run around. That's fine. That's good. What you are going to have trouble, though, is them calming down, right? So you might need to do these things backwards when you come in. And you may want them to do something else. You might want to bring in a heavy weight, so to speak. And they might want to wear a weighted vest. Sometimes the vest works, sometimes it doesn't. But this is a weighted vest, okay? And children wear it when they're doing their regular routine. The good thing about the weighted vest is that the child can do everything that the other children are doing, but they're just carrying weight. So they can still participate. It doesn't ostracize them. And this one looks kind of good. I actually wore a weighted vest when I had a meeting with a teacher. I forgot I was wearing it. And she didn't even notice that I was wearing it. And then I took it off to give it to her. And she said, oh, I didn't realize. So they don't look too bad.
Yes, ma'am. How do you decide on how much weight?
Yeah, I was just getting to that. It's no more than 10% of the body weight. However, you want to, I usually would start at maybe 5%, see if that's effective, and then move up to 10%. Okay? And you want it. Then you can either decide not to use it. Maybe they'll wear a heavy knapsack. Okay? Or this might be something that the OT strongly believes in, so we develop a strategy to increase their tolerance. So we would use a timer, or we have them complete, wear the vest while you're doing the puzzle, then it's all finished, and build their tolerance for the vest as you go. Mm-hmm. Definitely, when all of these things might be new and different for the child, so they're going to say, no, it's new and different, I don't like it. But you still want to pick one that you're going to start to incorporate, okay? No more than 10%, you wear it for 15 minutes, and then you take an hour break. Because if you do something that's really heavy work, like wear this or do a handstand, the effect lasts in your body for an hour before you are technically required to do another activity, okay? You can, yeah?
That's obviously
an OT to
say. Yes. What about the
way
backpack?
Yeah,
can
we
as a child that we're really can we do that properly?
Without me? I would say yes, but because of these new rules, I guess we have to bring it to the group of people that came up with the new rules and ask them. I think that the knapsack is not as on the body and the weight, as long as the weight, I guess The only concern is that the weight, there are still weight requirements, so I would need to make sure that everyone follows those weight requirements.
We should not.
So probably not, because of the weight requirements.
I was going to say, sometimes some children do like to help each other
That sort of infrequent use is fine, but in terms of a constant use, I think we probably have to go errands out of caution right now for that, because of the weight restrictions. Okay? So lunch, they can have, they can maybe wear the vest. They can wear the weighted vest. They can have the straw again. Okay? Nap time. Weighted blanket. Okay? Play time. They can play with some resistive toys. So lots of pushing and pulling of the Lego together. Okay? Maybe they can take the chairs out. Get them to do some heavy lifting. They can do, you can have fun with wheelbarrow walks if you have the back for it. Okay. Snack, same ideas as the lunch. More play, we could do, you can do playing on the floor so they can have to prop themselves up on their elbows. Or they might like the resistive toys again. Okay? Or they might need to take away from the activity. They may need to go over and push a plasticine against the wall. Okay? So that something is separate. So, oh, Johnny, I think you need to go. That's time for pressing your plasticine. Why don't you go make a pancake for me? Okay, good dog. Okay? Just an example. It's not a monster sensory diet, okay? It is something that's doable. And if you start off with one thing in your routine, that's great. And then you just keep going. Okay?
I have a question.
Yeah.
How
much time do they have to waste? Not most parents, if they know that their child might need it, it's fine. If you explain why they need it and if it's going to work, then they really like it. I've got a lot of
time too, like sleep in it.
No. The blanket sleeps for the whole nap, or the whole, like the child has one at home, they sleep all night. But the weight is the same, no more than 10%. Okay? So as you realize, then proprioceptive. Proprioceptive activities are the building blocks for the sensory diet. Okay? You can have other things in your sensory diet, but it does get tricky, so I just wanted to focus on the main area. I want you to remember that sensitivities can have a cumulative effect on the body, so they might not, if a child is sensitive to touch and they have to deal with grooming tasks in the morning, that's going to add a little bit to their weight, so their load of sensory acceptance, and then they have to deal with getting dressed in the area with all the children, and you have all these different experiences throughout the day, and some children will have behavioral issues later in the afternoon because they've had to deal with their sensory sensitivities throughout the day. So there's a general a picture of children who are sensitive who kind of melt down at 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon for just because someone touched them. Well, that little touch was the straw that broke the camel's back, and it really wasn't just that one touch, but it was all the touches throughout the whole day, which really makes us want to do these sensory activities throughout the day, so that you can reduce the impact, reduce that cumulative effect. You know you're doing a good job on your proprioceptive activities when you see that the child's face is less flushed, when you see that their breathing calms down, when their activity calms down, when their eye contact is better, when their language is better, you know that you're getting the right input. Okay? So we're going to just talk about motor planning. So we've already talked about that, so I'm going to skip that. So motor planning is a process for all of us when we are learning how to do something new that requires us to move. It is a process of sequencing ourselves to that new task. So if you can think of when you learn how to parallel park, or when you are, I always get the last, and when you are trying to find a new location in the city, you have to really think step by step how you're going to do it. And that thinking of step by step is using your motor plan. Okay? Once you use your motor planning and you get that car nicely in that spot, and you follow all the steps, and you are successful at finding that location in the city, and you do that over and over and over again, and then you find yourself not having to think about it anymore, not having to do that step-by-step process, you have moved from using your motor planning to automation. A lot of our day is automation. Thank goodness. Right? If our day was filled with motor planning, most of us would not leave the house. However, if you have a child who has difficulties with motor planning, their ability to move to that automation is difficult. So they will have most of their day as having to use their motor planning. And that can be extremely overwhelming. It has been compared to going to school on the first day of school, every day. The first day of work, of your new job, every day. And that is so much anxiety and so much stress, right? I depend on automation in my day, okay? So when we have a child who's having difficulties with motor planning, they are able to move to automation, but it's slower and it is not a smooth process. And they can get stuck and not get there for certain tasks. So, if you have difficulties with motor planning, you tend to avoid using it, which means that you avoid learning new things, avoid going new places, you avoid change, you might control your environment in order to eliminate change. You might control your environment so much that you can predict every minute so that you don't have to deal with change. And that might be a motor planning issue. A child who needs predictability, who requires predictability, and who may stay at the same activity every day, may have difficulties with motor planning. And this is significant because we all know that play is how children learn. So if a child only plays with the same thing every day, what's being affected most? Their learning, their cognitive development. So we need to find a way to expand their play, and we need to do it in a very predictable, sequential manner, because their problem with play is a sequencing issue. So these children actually need to be taught in a step-by-step manner how to play. They don't have the underlying skills to play on their own, to explore. They don't have the skills for self-direction, for exploring their environment. So they require us to help them with that. Once a child develops a certain amount of motor planning, you will find that they start to explore beyond what you've taught them, which is what we want, right? But some children are not at that stage yet. So please feel free, in my opinion, to interfere with a child's play if it's not expanding on its own. Give them the specifics. So if a child is playing with the wheel of a car, perhaps show them how to put the car down the ramp. Perhaps they might not do it. But if you give them an end point in which you will leave them alone, they may do it for you. So let's put the car down the ramp 3 times, then finished. Start with that. And then you will build from there. Maybe you'll put the cars down the ramp through the car wash. And then you might be able to see them do that on their own and expand. Okay? Essentially, difficulties with motor planning are a problem of feedback and feed forward. If you think about climbing a ladder, you have to use feedback to know whether you're doing the right thing. So if you're climbing a ladder and you miss a rung, you use feedback to know, oh, I lift my foot too high, or I lift my foot too low. And you use that information to decide how to change. But if you don't have the right information from everything we talked about earlier, so all these sensory stuff, you're not going to have the right feedback, so you're not going to make any changes, so you're going to miss the rung again, and again, and again, and then you're going to jump off the ladder and not go up the ladder. Okay? So it's a process of the child learning how to use this information, how to get information, and how to use it to know what to do differently. Children, people who have difficulties with motor planning do not come up with alternative plans very easily. I myself have fight for motor planning, and I still get a knot in my stomach if we don't go grocery shopping at home on Wednesday. What am I going to do?
Yep.
Okay. My husband usually goes grocery shopping because he loves to shop, so he goes and does that. And if he has to go out, I get a little panicky. What am I going to do? Even though I have enough food in the fridge to last the day, we don't usually leave it, you know, completely bare, but I get a little snot in my stomach figuring out, okay, Thursday night, we can still do that. That's okay. I got to think about how to do that, and then I'm fine. Whereas my husband is just like, yeah, we'll do it Thursday. Like, his motor planning is very different from mine. So he knows I go through anxiety because I talk about it. Okay, we're shopping on Thursday. Okay, that means this, 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 and this. And he's like, stop. It's fine. It will work out. But I have to process it so that I can predict it so I can feel comfortable. Okay? So we don't like change. And I'll say we because I'm one of them. Okay? So what we need to do is find the stage, especially when we're doing sequencing, we need to find the stage that the child's having difficulty with, give them the correct amount of input, and decide how to, so they can use that information to change. So for example, climbing the ladder, maybe putting ankle weights on the child's legs might help them feel their legs better. So then they can use that information to know how to climb the ladder better. Okay? Or you might want to have the child look down at their feet. They may not be using their vision. So look at your feet. Oh, look at your feet. All right? Or the child may not realize that the car and the ramp go together. So if we give them just information, they can maybe learn from what you're doing and move forward. Okay? So it's not just breaking the task down into steps. It's also trying to figure out if the child is missing information. Okay? Sensory integration treatment, just so you're aware, is a type of therapy that occupational therapists do provide. We cannot provide it in the daycare because there is not enough, we don't have a clinic room. If you built me a clinic room, I would do therapy in your daycare. But that's not going to happen, right? It requires a clinic because it requires equipment, and it mostly requires a lot of suspended equipment. Swings. We use swings in very different ways that you may be very surprised about. And if you see an OT session, you might think that it's just play, of course, but it's not, right? So it is all about giving a child a purposeful goal and for them to be able to feel the feedback. So we're not just going to do a puzzle, but we're going to do a puzzle while we are sitting on a scooter. And we're going to move the scooter back and forth from the pieces to the board. Okay? This is a goal-directed task. It provides the child with feedback of where their body is in space, and they learn a lot more than just sitting at the table. Another one would be putting a child in a net swing, which they can lie on their tummy and look like Superman. And we give them bean bags, and they try and toss the bean bag in the bucket. So what they are required to do and what they will learn was when should they let go of the bean bag. If they let go of the bean bag too early, they miss.
So I might slow the swing down so that they can feel, and I might give them a verbal cue of, okay, ready and throw. And then they throw the beanbag in. And what happens is that they learn the sequence and the timing of being successful at that task. So they learn how to process the feedback and use it for feed forward. Therapy does transfer. So even though you will not be doing anything with swings, a child will benefit from the improvements they make in therapy will transfer into their everyday use. And it does require them to do something. So swinging in a swing is not sensory integration therapy. Swinging in a swing and doing a puzzle is sensory integrated therapy. Push a therapy ball through a Spandex tunnel. They have to push and push and push and push. And I bet if some of the kids I put through that tunnel, they start off red-faced and all sorts of energy. And when they come out at the end of the tunnel, they've worked so hard in there that they're calm and ready to work. It's very magical. I love that one. Okay? So just want you to know that there is therapy out there that really does address those five steps. That's what it's for. And I'm not going to be able to do that in your daycare, but we can still use the strategies such as the sensory diet to help these children. Okay? But I might be recommending, or the OT in your daycare might recommend therapy, and I want you to know what that is so that you can support the parent in understanding that. You can get therapy through private practice, or you can have the child be put on a wait list for a clinic at Scarborough General, North York. Don't think Centenary does direct treatment. They are very long wait lists. For about a year, and you get 10 sessions. So I usually recommend it, and when I recommend it, I really want it to be done quickly so the child doesn't have to wait very long. It's extremely effective. I saw a child once, and I did my stuff with him, and one of the difficulties was that he wouldn't go to a different grocery store, wouldn't go to a different park, mom had to go buy a different store and buy milk on the way home, he'd have a complete meltdown. And I saw him in therapy, and the mom came one day and said, we went to a new park. And I never took him to a new park. I didn't show him what to do in a new park. But that information did transfer into his everyday. Okay? I do want to talk a little bit about sensory processing and feeding. Okay? Now, obviously, feeding is a very difficult area. I cannot provide a lot of specifics because there's a lot of safety issues involved with feeding, like choking and gagging. So I will provide some ideas, but it would be irresponsible of me to give you specifics to try, especially when it has to do with a child being comfortable with food in their mouth. I cannot give a definite answer unless I see what they do with it in their mouth. So my specific strategies will probably be as simple as possible. Okay? If a child is having oral motor difficulties, they're not chewing the food, okay? They're gagging on the food, the OT has to see that. Okay? It's very complicated. Alright? But I want to talk a little bit about feeding so that you can appreciate the sensory component to it. And we know that when we are sensitive to tactile input, it will affect the use of our tools. So if we don't feel the spoon in our hand, we won't use it. If we don't feel the cup in our hand, we won't use it. If the spoon or the cup feels like sandpaper, we won't touch it. Mm-hmm. Right? So we have to look at that if that's an issue for the child. Okay? Responsiveness to oral input. If we're sensitive to touch in our mouth, okay, we may not develop the oral motor skills such as biting, chewing, lateralization, which is moving food around in your mouth. We won't develop those skills because we won't let food go in our mouth and that it will affect our ability to manage the table food that people put in front of us. Okay? If we are sensitive to foods, but we have developed a tolerance out of the need to survive for chicken, bread, rice, and apples, we still may be very sensitive to food. We've just picked a particular few that we will be okay with, and the rest is unpredictable, and so we will not feel comfortable with them. Okay? So some children who are very specific with their food preferences have just been able to find a way to be comfortable with a particular kind of food, and the rest of them, they won't even try. Okay? So they still could be sensitive. Other children will only eat puree. They won't even progress to the chicken. They will just stay at the 6-month level of eating puree food because it is too sensitive for them to eat. Remember we talked about light touch being uncomfortable? So when you bite into a cookie, that bite is hard, right? It's resistant. Nice, I like that. But as soon as you finish that bite, you have little pieces of that cookie in your mouth. That's light touch. Yeah, I don't want that. So I'm not going to eat the cookie. But I will eat the toy. Or I will eat the stick. Because when I bite the stick, it doesn't break off into little uncomfortable pieces. Okay? So there will be children who will almost eat a toy, but only eat puree food. And you'll wonder, why won't they eat food? They can bite. We know they can bite. But they are biting to try because they're too sensitive.
Okay? And they cannot manage the unpredictability of the food in their mouth. Okay? Oral motor skills could be delayed due to difficulties. There is a feeding clinic, autism feeding clinic, at North York General that children can be referred to. A doctor has to make a referral. And you do not need to be in the catchment area of North York because it is the only clinic out there. It's a very, very, very long wait list, but at least the child can be on the wait list and try and get some service. Okay? So some possible strategies for a child who is the under-responsive. So you have to know that this child is under-responsive. If you do not know, if you have not been told the child is under-responsive, please do not try these strategies. But please keep these in mind so when the OT says unresponsive, you can check with them and say, okay, can I do this, this, this? I'm ready. I can do it. Okay? But I really cannot recommend you do them unless you know that the child is under-responsive. And the only way I can confirm that you'll know that is by talking to an occupational therapist. Okay? But I hope that when you get those strategies, you'll have an understanding of why the OT is recommending them, and then you'll go full force after. Okay? So if the child is under-responsive, they're not feeling the food, they don't know where the food is in their mouth, they food falls out of their mouth and they don't even know it, they stuff too much food in their mouth because they don't realize their mouth is full, okay? You might be able to wake their mouth up, doing facial massages, giving them cold liquid, using candy spray before they eat. It's not a lot of sugar, it's really incidental, okay? Wake the mouth up though, because it's sour, and boy, oh boy, would that child start to feel their cheeks and their tongue, the inside of their mouth, and they'll be able to finally feel it, okay? Remember we talked at the very beginning about how our vision tends to compensate for our lack of other skills. We cannot see inside our mouth. So if a child has poor body awareness, and they don't know where their body is, they're not going to know what's going on inside their mouth, and they can't look at it just to make sense of it. So we might want to use a mirror during meals so they can actually start to see inside their mouth when they are learning to chew. Okay? It's amazing when you see a child who doesn't know what their mouth is like, have them chew a carrot or a licorice with a mirror. They just look at it, and all of a sudden the mystery is gone. Mm-hmm. They know what's happening in there. Because if your mouth is numb, just like you've come from the dentist, okay, and you can't feel anything in there, you have to go in the bathroom and check to make sure you've got everything out, right? And because you can't feel it. You can't feel it. If you haven't listened to the doctor, wait until you're freezing all the way off. You really want that cookie. You eat it, you're not going to know where it is. You're going to have to check to make sure you emptied your mouth, okay? So you can use cold liquid throughout the meal to keep them awake. I had a mom once that had crunchy foods at the side of the table. So while her daughter would eat her rice meal, she would, every two or three bites, she would eat a bite of carrot because the crunchiness would wake up her mouth. It would make it faster for her to eat, and then she could go ahead and eat the softer stuff more effectively. Being over-responsive is very hard to take care of because the child has definitely learned that they do not like things in their mouth. They've learned for a long time. They do not want to mess around with that. But what I would probably suggest is some proprioceptive activities before the meals, doing some handstands, wheelbarrow walking, wrap them tightly in a towel and sing a song. Giving them that whole body calming is going to help with the face. Giving deep pressure facial massages. Again, drinking from a thin straw is pressure resistant. It's going to reduce the sensitivities in the mouth. Okay? Then you've got the body ready, but the mind is probably going to get in the way. The mind is going to remember that I don't like eating these foods. And then you need to get some behavioral strategies involved to help them feel comfortable. If it's not too severe, though, these things can make the difference without anything else. Okay? So you want to use pressure to calm the child's body and their mouth. If they will accept crunchy foods like the apple, then give them the apple and then maybe pair it with a new food that they're not sure about. Okay. For tool use, these are things you can definitely do, okay? Because I know the child is going to be, you're not going to force the child to eat. So you might want to try a weighted utensil, weighted spoon, or a weighted fork, to see if it gives the child more sense, more feeling of that spoon. Give them more feedback so they can be more accurate, so the spoon doesn't tip over so quickly. You might want to use the mirror so they can see where their mouth is, so they can be accurate in where it is. Because they may be missing their mouth because they don't know where it is. Okay? You may want to obviously provide some meals that are going to be successful, like yogurt or pudding, so that the child does feel the success. And you want to use backwards chaining to teach the child how to use the tool. Just to confirm, backwards chaining is teaching the child the last step first. Okay? So when you're using a spoon, the last step is to put the spoon in their mouth. So you might hold their hand for the whole scooping process, going up to their mouth, and then you're going to let go right at their mouth, and it goes in. And then slowly step back and maybe let get through the scooping part, and then let go halfway to their mouth, let them do the rest of it on their own, and so on. So the last thing that they learn is how to scoop. Okay?
So I just have a case study that we don't have to go through, or I can bring it up. I can read through it and I'll give you my ideas, and if you have any questions before we finish off this morning. So I picked this little guy, out of my imagination and the kids I see. He has delays in his motor skills. He's unable to ride a bike, draw, build blocks to complete a puzzle. When he picks up a crayon, he'll look at it and throw it away. He's very impulsive, he tends to move around a lot. He appears clumsy, doesn't always seem to watch where he's going. He falls a lot. He leans against the other children in a circle. He tends to stand to do his work or play with his chair. He rushes to get dressed, but isn't successful. He's very social, loves to please others, and has great memory for people and events. So maybe you might think of this little guy differently after what we talked about this morning. You might think of how is he processing his information and how is that giving him misinformation, so he's doing his own thing. I think he's got low registration because he's not engaging in his play, and he's not using the crayon, he's just throwing it away, he doesn't feel it. So I might put put sandpaper behind the paper, so when he does do drawings, it's bumpy, and he'll feel the bumps. It might make him feel like there's more there. You can also use weighted pencil, weighted crayon. But a cheaper alternative, maybe use a sandpaper. Try that first. Why do you think, does anyone have an idea of why he might be really rushing to get dressed but this isn't successful? Like, he wants to go out? Do you think he might have motor planning difficulty? Because he knows what the end result is supposed to be. He knows that he wants to get dressed, but he can't sequence himself through it. So he gets all mixed up in the steps. He knows what he wants to do. He loves to move, so he wants to go out. So it's like parallel parking. You know the car is supposed to sit in that spot, but just doing it is another story, right? So it's not that he maybe can't do the dressing. He just doesn't have those steps. He's skipping steps. He's missing them. So he has to be more sequential. The picture sequences, right? You want to use his memory to his advantage, okay? He likes to please others, so if you do use a picture sequencing and he gets to put the pictures in the finished and he gets praised for that, he's probably going to benefit from that. He's probably going to love the picture sequence. And he probably won't need to use that picture sequence after a while because he'll probably remember it. The difference between now and when you do the visual is that you're moving from just telling him what to do to showing him the pictures. And showing the pictures is actually a lot easier for us to remember. Most of us remember things when we hear them and see them. Okay? So seeing it is very important. And he might need his own picture sequence. Or he might need, if you have a picture sequence up but don't refer to it, he may need guidance on how to actually use it. Okay? So they can get very busy when you get dressed, especially in the winter. And so children may not actually use what you have up on the wall. Okay? But giving a reward system, perhaps, for him, might be very helpful. Yes?
Do you have a copy of the case study for them?
I'm sorry?
Do you have a copy of that to hand out?
It's on the back of the
name. Because I was looking at it.
You don't have it? Do you have a page 9?
Okay.
I might want to use a cushion for him so he can sit in a circle. I might want to have him do some of these resistive tasks on his way out or his way in, get him calmer. So you want to use their strengths. They've got good memory. They love to look at things. You really want to use those visuals. The visuals are a to-do list, okay? And I have my to-do list, my agenda book, my date book, is my visual cue, right? And I wouldn't leave the house without it, okay? So although we might have visual cues up, if we don't apply them for certain children, we're not going to see the same benefit. And I would hazard a guess there's more people in here that use visual cues for themselves than not. So we don't want to underestimate the importance of it, okay? And for these children, it can be the difference between understanding what you're saying and not understanding. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Jennifer. I know for me, and I'm sure for most of you, talking about understanding, it's given me a greater understanding of sensory integration and what it's all about. As you were saying before, sometimes the sensory, you think sensory activities, and that's all that that sensory means to you, sort of thing. But sensory integration goes way beyond that. And you've given us some wonderful examples and just some really good knowledge we can take back with us.
Thanks
so much,
Jennifer. Thanks, everybody.